Hello, this is Art Monthly Monthly, the magazine programme on Resonance Radio for Art Monthly magazine, and we're now discussing some of the content in the April issue of Art Monthly, but we're going to focus primarily on some letters which came in, which are to do with the Byam Shore occupation. Now, this is a very interesting subject to Art Monthly, and it follows on from an issue we had previously, which was a special issue on education, where we had various pieces from different people working in art schools and a feature by the editor, Patricia Bickers. Now, with us today in the studio, John Rees and Jess Scott are the students, but with them also is Jamie Wagg, who works at the art school. First of all, I'm going to ask John and Jess to talk about what's happened at Byam Shore and what they did, how it began. First of all, Jess, would you like to just say a little bit about the early pre-stages before your occupation of Byam Shore College?
Well, we've been having discussions basically since the autumn before this happened, so back in October, writing letters. We sent a letter to Nigel Carrington, who's the rector of the university, with a list of demands signed by practically all the students. And the responses we got were fairly dismissive. We were sent to talk to PR people. There wasn't really any attempt to address the issues seriously, and it seemed like we were really being fobbed off by what was going on, which is what led to us deciding to go into occupation.
Can I ask you what the issues were that you were trying to raise? In other words, what it was that you were dissatisfied with?
Well, for a start, the tutorial hours and the budget had been cut significantly, and budget changes were only passed on to our tutors on the Wednesday before university started on the Monday. There was no prior warning of what was going to happen.
To the tutors?
Yeah. Teaching materials for other courses have been cut, such as the FDA course. We're on the BA course. The workshops, their budgets have been cut and opening hours for them. There was problems with transparency. No one was telling us what was going on, and students who worked for the college weren't getting paid. And we basically wanted to have a say and know what was going on.
Yeah, so it was more about, to begin with, perhaps finding out what the situation was as much as demanding change, or is that wrong? John, have a go.
Yeah, it led to, we were generally unhappy with the communication. You know, we tried, you know, the course representatives tried to go through the proper channels to have meetings. As Jess said, we wrote this petition, and we wanted to open a discussion about, you know, the service that we were being provided, you know, which, when we joined Byam Shore, was a good service, and we were very happy with.
So that had been going on for a little while. I mean, things had been okay.
Yeah.
And then there was a change, basically. So you were happy at Byam Shore, which has a history of being an independent art school, and you joined it knowing that was the situation.
Yeah.
And then things changed. My understanding is that there's a link between, or there became a link between Byam Shore, which wasn't totally independent, then with Central St Martins, which used to be part of the London Institute before it was on its own, and then it became part of University of the Arts London. And that's when Byam Shore joined, I think, the University of the Arts London, but as a part of Central St Martins.
Yeah.
Is that 4 years ago, I think?
I think it's five.
Five years, yes. So basically something had happened in that joining which had upset the way things were running at Byam Shore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a national survey of students, and the University of the Arts have come bottom of that survey, 3 years running. Byam Shore has scored very highly in that survey.
Yes.
And what they decided, you know, I think they called it ring fencing. For the first couple of years, they ring fenced our tutorial hours and our studio space.
Kept them as they were.
Yeah, and you know, and then in the last 2 years, they've started to whittle away to bring us down to the level.
Yeah, down being the operative word.
Exactly, to match those of Central St Martins.
The satisfied level of the... Yeah, yes, the which bottom. Is interesting and odd thing to do when you think about it in those terms.
Exactly, you know, and we just felt that, you know, this was a ridiculous way to treat students, and a ridiculous way to try and, you know, raise their student satisfaction.
Yes. Well, it doesn't sound like that was their priority or their preoccupation, probably. So you had a sort of failed attempt, not on your part of failing, but on their point of not listening. And when that didn't work, you then decided to do something more radical, would you say?
Yeah.
Jess, how would you describe the next stage that happened?
Well, there was a stage of organisation. There were a couple of people who are in our year went round and talked personally to you know, 100 or so of the students each, to get people's opinions on what was going to happen. We decided that we'd go into occupations. We spent time planning that. There was no warning given to the staff or anything. It was only us that knew what was going to happen. And then we went along to the principal of the college on Wednesday and said, "We're not going to leave tonight. We thought we'd better tell you." Yes. And he tried to convince us not to.
I'm not surprised.
We still stayed anyway and said, we're not moving until our demands are met.
Right.
Which essentially also served, because we've been trying to get meetings with the head of St Martin's and things like this to discuss matters. And
well, so sort of going over the head of Byam Shores job to the next level of management, really, because these places are all managed now. Mm. And that hadn't worked.
No, she basically didn't really seem to take us very seriously, so we knew we had to do something in an attempt to make...
So it was partly a sign you were giving out by the occupation, as well as a literal occupation. It was saying, we are here, take note, something's happening.
Very much, yeah.
OK, and just in practical terms, can you say... So it gets dark, and the tutors presumably all go home to tea with their children in suburban homes or wherever they live. Sorry, that's not really fair to tutors. And you stayed. So what about the keys? I mean, just literally, and food, and this isn't going to go on for... This went on for longer than one night, I understand.
Yeah, it went on for 9 days.
Yes, and 9 nights, I presume, or 8 nights or something.
Yeah, 9 nights. I mean, quickly we organised groups. So we tried to do everything on in a consensus level, so we sat in a circle, and we talked about how to, you know, how we were going to get over all the hurdles that obviously, you know, the occupation would bring up. And so we formed groups to deal with food and groups to deal
right.
with...
Right, so people volunteered, as it were, did they? did you find... I mean, you said a circle, which I think is a marvellous configuration for a sort of open forum without chair people and all this sort of stuff. But did you end up having some sort of people who tended to be more dominant in decision-making, or did you find that didn't really happen? Just out of interest.
I mean, we tried... What we did was we had a system where one person spoke at a time, and and if people were in agreement with that, they'd use hand signals to let the group know. So they would, you know, if you raised and wiggled your hands, you agreed with something. If you waved your hands down,
so you sort of developed systems, as it were, or they came naturally.
That worked incredibly well.
Yeah. And, so you didn't have any sort of really nasty fallouts during this time, in so much as it that disrupted the whole principle of what you were doing.
At all, no.
Great.
You know, we tried to pass around the chairing of the meetings, and but so that there wasn't... You know, we were very clear that we didn't want leaders of the occupation.
Yes, no, and it's a very open sort of situation by the sound of it. It does, what it sounds to me like is a completely different structure to the structure of the institution that you were actually trying to deal with. And in a way, the way you were doing it was possibly the way actually you'd like really to have been at art school or an institute. That's where you'd like the institution to have been able to run, ideally, I would assume.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the really...
This is Jamie.
The really interesting thing about the occupation... was that, and the decision to occupy was born from a kind of love for the school. I mean, that was a real respect for the school and for the teaching staff and for the principal. I mean, that night, the principal stayed all night with the students, which I think is makes it really different to any of the other kind of student revolts or student rebellions or student occupations that have happened.
Yes.
They weren't actually against the school, they were for the school, and they wanted to retain the school and maintain
the
school.
Well, no, the letters in Art Monthly, I think it says that it was done out of a desire to keep what you had, not change what there was.
But
more than become something else.
But more than that, it wasn't just like, you know, to keep the kind of systems or bureaucracies. It was a genuine love for the community of the school, because it is it's a relatively small school. It's 400 students or something.
Yes, which is small, and presumably most people would know most people. How many people were in the occupation in the end? You said 100 earlier, I think.
At times it varied, but it was up to 100 people. We'd have meetings where, you know, 60, 70 people in our meetings. And the other very interesting thing was, in the end, because of the systems we used, most decisions we came to were unanimous. So we got to a situation where, you know, 60, 70 people were all in agreement with each other over what we should do to move forward.
Yes. Which is quite amazing, really. I mean, you're talking nearly 50% of students, which is a high percentage. I mean, yeah, very interesting. And I think what I am interested in talking about as well is where it developed and then what happened after that. So in other words, how would you view the success of this? Jess, would you say that, you know, after that, when you made, presumably you were recognised as what you were doing, there was a different relationship between you and the institution. What happened there?
It's hard to say. I think the institution did realise that they couldn't fob us off, and I think in a way they'd almost be wise to be a bit wary of what we're doing and what we've been up to, because they pushed us to this point where we've had to do this, but what we've really come out of it realising is that we can kind of function without them, but they can't function without us. We can, you know, provide a kind of good education for ourselves where we're forced to question, you know, to get along, to make work and make it in a far more organic and natural way than is done through a kind of pathway structured education system where there are constraints placed on us, you know, to do work in certain things at different times. And
you're saying you think they've understood that from you guys? Or is that something you've learned yourself, because you thought a lot about that during the time that you were doing the occupation?
I think that's certainly something we all learned for ourselves.
Yes, yes.
I learned an awful lot.
You did an exhibition during the occupation, didn't you? What did you do? Tell us, John.
I think by the weekend, we occupied on the Wednesday night, and by the weekend people were getting frustrated because, you know, we weren't making work. We were spending a lot of time sitting in a circle discussing.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, that's creative people you like to do.
Yeah, and we were starting to get frustrated, and so people just wanted to start making stuff, and, you know, and so they did. And
what was it like? I mean, was it coming out of what you were doing, or was it like what you were doing anyway before?
No, it's very much coming out of what we were doing. You know, people started to make films, do performances, people started to make structures. There was this big metal structure.
But were the subjects, would you say, of the work related to an occupation to do with the relationship between institutions, whether it be metaphorical or literally?
Yeah, some of the work was very literal. Some of it was spray-painted canvases. Some of it was photographs of, you know, the occupation.
So literally documenting what you were doing, perhaps?
Yes, and then some of it was maybe ideas that people had already, but which definitely related. You know, there was the structure that was built was quite constrictive and quite...
Was that a collaborative structure made by more than one artist?
No, this was one guy.
Did everyone tend to still make work on their own, or did people make work as one?
Both. I mean, collaborated, and people started curating each other's work and moving each other's work around.
Right.
And
quite playful then.
Yeah, very playful.
Which possibly wasn't happening before to the same degree. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe not in that way. So that we were making work 24 hours. So, you know, people were working 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
You know, making work, and people, you know, were getting up, you know, immediately walking into the gallery and were happening in a different way, really interesting ways.
Whereas before you'd have had to leave the college at a certain time and leave your work in the college in the main and then come back in the morning, a bit more like a job in a way. Yeah. This is more like life, perhaps. Mm. We better just move on and ask about the situation that then happened, because I believe you have a charter that you've got agreed with the upper management of UAL, I think I'm right. Can you just briefly say what that's about, Jess? Or anybody, doesn't matter. I mean, what did you get agreed? Is it stuff you wanted agreed, or was it a compromise, say?
We got an awful lot of what we wanted. We got a cash injection so we can have more tutorials this year.
Is that like visiting tutors coming in? Great.
Yeah. Yep. They agreed to do a cost-benefit analysis for the cleaning, which we weren't happy about, and that we could have a vote on student meetings. Meetings with management, whether that will come to fruition or not.
You mean at meetings where management and students would come together as if they were going to sort of discuss things on an equal level about the way the course was going to go, and then you would vote, and that's not yet actually occurred. Is that what you're saying?
I think theoretically that's how it should work, but I'm not sure if management would get that.
Is it on the charter?
It is on the
charter.
In some
way.
Yeah.
So they could be held to it. Can I just ask one quick question? The charter's obviously there. You guys may be in your third year and be going to leave. And do you think that the second year students, and do you think that the charter itself will actually stay, you know, be effective? Or do you think when you leave, it'll all just be, they'll try and forget it?
We really hope that, you know, the students that are there after we leave will pick it up and, you know, pick up
the
baton.
Yes, of course. No.
But the charter, I mean, there's a possibility. I think there's some delaying tactics going on with the management at the moment where they're trying to kind of... They're waiting for us to leave, I think.
Well, because that is actually the reality of the situation, isn't it? Because that's why I asked about, you know, what happened about locks and keys, which I actually forgot to say. Did you actually get keys to lock up, or did you just all keep it open, by the way?
We kept it open.
So it was open all night, really?
Well, yeah. You know, we tried to keep all the staff there on board, like the security guards.
You had the place guarded by the people who were supposed to do it, but they were doing it for you instead.
Well, kind
That's
of.
Marvelous.
We tried to be nice to people.
To
involve them in the communal meals. To bring them tea and all that sort of those little touches.
That actually reminds me of a photograph, which is of the another occupation or sit-in, I think it possibly was called, back in 1968 in what was then called Hornsey College of Art. And Jamie, who's with us, knows quite a lot about that. But there is a photograph of a security guard, I think, with his Alsatian dog outside a window, and the window's open, and there's a student inside. And I think he's drinking a cup of tea, which has clearly been provided by the students inside. So it's quite interesting that that's actually... I mean, they were sent in to throw everyone out and just decided they couldn't do it and ended up having cups of tea.
Well, Hornsey was a very different kind of occupation because the students actually excluded the staff from the school. They actually sort of, not the staff, but the principal. So they actually took over the school,
yes.
Which is different to the Biomshore occupation because they actually allowed, in fact, supported the general day-to-day running of the school.
Yes.
Which made that a very different situation.
Right,
and with the Hornsey one, it's often said, that the authorities went in with the dogs and cleared the students out. Well, that didn't happen. They went in with the dogs, and the dogs got fed by the students, and they all became mates. Hornsey was given back to the authorities, to Haringey Council at the time, because they'd been given certain assurances and certain promises, which actually weren't upheld. I mean, Kim Hells, one of our Labour MPs, was actually part of all of that, and knows all that. I mean, many of the students and the staff were actually then excluded and sacked.
Yes.
Come August, September.
Can I ask you a question about that? Because that, again, relates back to the charter we have now, and that doesn't bode well, does it? But it's obviously there's something possibly to be learned.
Well, I think I think one of the absolute fabulous things about the students at the Biomshore and their occupation. I mean, I thought it was marvellous. I think the education they received over those 9 days was enormous, just in terms of collaboration, organisation, responsibility, how to get things done, how
diplomacy.
All of that was I mean, it's almost like you'd want at least once every 3 years you'd want that to be part of the curriculum. So that in your third year you have a 2 week
you will
have a 2 week occupation because it was for some people it was very stressful. I think for some members of the management it was very stressful, but for the students I think it was a fabulous education and it certainly was a very creative environment.
And not aggressive in any way, from what I understand. Which is
well, like I said earlier, it was born of a love for the school and not just a love for the teaching practices, but also a love for the community, which many of the students, I think, maybe feel is under threat.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the education system, to broaden the conversation out a little bit, perhaps, we have a complicated situation now, obviously, where government is being quite... It's probably quite a big cause of the way the universities are.
Yeah.
And I don't pretend to fully understand it. I know there's a lot of research which is paid for by government and it's necessary.
I mean, for me, I think Britain has had an incredibly, a worldwide unique art school system. It isn't like in Germany. It isn't like in France. It isn't like in America. It's really very unique. And I would argue that it's actually been the driving force of the British economy since about 1958. Now, I know they didn't become artists and they didn't become, world famous, but just a quick list of all the people who have contributed to the popular culture of Britain and the finances of Britain and the exchequer of Britain and the revenue and the foreign currency that's been brought into Britain... John Lennon went to art school.
Who went to art school?
John Lennon went to art school. Paul McCartney and George Harrison went to the grammar school next to the art school, and the Beatles used to practice in the art school because that was an environment they could practice in. Ray Davis went to art school. Eric Clapton went to art school. Jimmy Page went to art school. David Bowie went to art school.
Brian Eno
went to art school. Malcolm McLaren went to art school. The list is endless. Peter Townsend went to art school. It was a very sexist situation in those days. But, I mean, just imagine the amount of revenue that just those people... And they didn't go to music college.
No.
They went to art school. And I would suggest that the most economic, efficient use of taxpayers' money is to allow young people to explore their imaginations,
yeah,
and their creativity for 3 years, and nothing but good will follow. And one of the things that I think this government is doing right now, or has been doing since Thatcher, really, and I don't want to sort of blame, go to that kind of, oh, it's all Thatcher's fault, mm-hmm, but what is happening now was actually instigated back then. And it's this kind of university sort of status that all education has to have was sort of started there. I think this is actually killing the goose that lays the golden, yeah, egg for British popular culture. And just let me finish.
Is this
race for art schools, for art education, to become, for everybody to become academics?
Yeah, that's what I was
going
to say.
So everybody becomes, yeah, kind of the academic. Before I came in today, I just opened up the Oxford English Dictionary to look up the definition of academic. The first definition is scholarly of a university. The second definition is dull, conservative, conformist, over-formal. I mean, all the way when I was a student, for the last 100 years, to call someone merely academic was to actually was the highest term of abuse.
Yes, yes.
Oh, this is merely academic.
Yes.
Now everybody is fighting over each other to become an academic.
Okay, just practically, but I'm sure Independent feels it needs to join UAL. Okay,
forced to.
Okay, by who?
Well, by the government, because otherwise we wouldn't get Hefke funding, and we wouldn't, and the students wouldn't have access to student loans.
So in other words, it's the structure of how art schools are funded, yeah, that has forced them to become part of universities who tend to be based in this academic approach.
But are also you know, overwhelmingly design-led. You know, they have projects.
Yes.
They have customers.
We mean
they
consumer have, product
they
making
They have market
led.
Share. They have, you know, where are you going to place your product? Where are you going to go? But they're killing it dead. I mean, it's about managing. It's about managing creative. It's about, you know, it's about being in control. Some bureaucrat somewhere has got to be in control of this. And my argument is that it's that lack of control. It's that absolute freedom. I think what it is that Hefke, the Higher Education Funding Council, believes that, you know, that small schools are somehow educationally inefficient, and so therefore have to be part of a greater university to receive that kind of funding, and that's actually a more efficient way to deliver education. Whereas I think within art education, which is the education I really know and have been involved in for the last 30 years, it's actually the opposite. It's actually smaller units. You know, art education is, after all, so much more different to any other kind of education. You know, you study geography, you know that Paris is the capital of France, and you know that, you know, New York is in North America. But art education, there are no answers. It's always questions. You know, you're always challenging, and you're always challenging the previous generation's ideas. And it's all about asking questions and not about getting answers. So within art education, there's no right and wrong. There's no kind of, this is the right answer, and this is right art, and this is wrong art. That doesn't work in art schools. And so the kind of models that the higher education facilitators are trying to impose on our education, I think, are actually counterproductive, counterintuitive, and they're just not the way that art is taught.
Yeah. It doesn't fit, does it?
I think the fact that UAL is geared towards producing products rather than art education, as Jamie's been, you know,
yes,
been talking about it, it's, you know, it's kind of, I feel that they're looking at it as a business. You know, we want to roll out people who make products, who can, you know, who make images that are going to sell immediately. It's all about,
you mean, like career,
yeah,
almost,
yeah,
over quality, say, or of experience, or,
yeah,
right. Do you think the university as a whole is aimed that way? I mean, do you think other subjects that are like that, therefore they just, yeah, apply that?
Well, because the University of the Arts is primarily design-based, design courses, students who study design, they go and get that job for Versace, or they go and get that job at Dolce & Gabbana, or they go and get that job at McCann Erickson, whereas an art student works as a postman or as a gardener to try and keep their practice going for as long as possible. So when it comes to that survey, after you've been out of college for a year or 2 years, what are you up to? Oh, I've got a job for Versace, or I've got a job for Dolce & Gabbana. Oh, I'm working at McDonald's and I work in a bar at night, but I've got a studio, I'm working at the weekends, and I've just got into the Young Contemporaries, or something like that. And it kind of doesn't fit to again doesn't fit that kind of model. I mean, what's more interesting is to look and see what art students are actually doing 5 years, 10 years, 15 years after they leave college. And actually, you'll find that many art students, because they haven't been geared towards a specific job, that actually they have these what you call transferable skills. They have this ability to, because they've been forced to design their own course, design their own area of research, they actually are far more mobile in terms of how they use their creativity, how they use their imaginations within the workplace. And I'm recently organising an exhibition at the Brimshaw of students who have been gone over a 15-year period, and to find that they're all, you know, one is the senior art director at MTV Europe, one is a senior designer for a haute couture bespoke fashion designer, one is a TV personality and published chef, and you know, who's in the same sort of league as Jamie Oliver. And they just kind of list, they're all, one has just set up the conservation department at St Paul's Cathedral, the first ever director.
One's the deputy editor of Art Monthly as well.
One is the deputy editor of Art Monthly and runs his own publishing company.
He does.
You know, I mean, it's just amazing.
Yes.
You know, and they all still make their work and they all still make their art, but they're all in all these incredibly different fields, and that doesn't get picked up in the bureaucracy.
Well, it doesn't fit the way they try and take the stats down, does it, basically?
You study fine art, you leave, you do your three-year degree, yeah, but what job do you get? What's the job in fine art?
Well, what that implies is the distance between the top management who are assessing all these figures and the floor level in the art school. Jess, I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, there's the kind of government's initiative of skills-based economy at the moment, knowledge economy, and it's an idea that you can go to university and learn a specific set of skills and that will provide for the economy. And it's when you go to art school, you can learn something that's more about the kind of funding principle of education, the philosophies behind it, to have the freedom to learn, to explore, that you won't get on a course that's more kind of based around unitization and things like that. And I think that really it's like,
I've lost my mind.
It's more like that higher education has become a kind of substitute for what used to be called the old apprenticeship scheme, where you're trained to get a job. Whereas, you know, I think education, higher education, is actually, especially for an art school anyway, is actually about challenging preconceived ideas, challenging the status quo, and that's how culture and that's how the economy moves forward.
Yes.
By resting on your laurels and saying, this is it, that's how you die. But fine art education actually encourages you, teaches you how to challenge the status quo, challenge that complacency. And that, like I said, is that how culture, and that's how British culture has moved forward since the late 50s.
I think the management, you know, they're trying to quantify the unquantifiable. They're trying to say, well, how can we measure this? Which is successful? Which do we need, you know, to put the money into? Where's the money going to come out of? And they can't quantify that with art schools, and especially, you know, if the results are happening 10, 15 years down the line, because they, you know, they just can't see that. Too short-sighted to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very interesting situation, and the conversation's been great, guys. I mean, we really could go on, and there's an awful lot to talk about, but thank you all ever so much for coming in. And the two students here, John and Jess, just say briefly, what are your hopes for the future, for yourselves, and, particularly, I think, really, for yourselves. So when you leave, do you know what you're going to do?
Well, I don't, but what's come out of the occupation is a sense of, a real bond, a real sense of community between the students that I've been on the course with, and hopefully we can continue that and continue making work together and continue having these conversations, and who knows?
Yes, yes. And Jess, would you say similar?
I'd say similar, and it's kind of something that's also been born out of the occupation. I don't think there is the aim when you leave art school to go out and find a job that you're going to have for the next 20, 30 years. My personal aim is to find a job so I can pay the rent, and then I can do what I want to do in my spare time, be creative.
Yes,
but of course that doesn't look good on paper, and it makes us look poor as a university. But it's the most important.
Well, no, but that as we've been saying, that isn't really critically important, is it? It's your own education that matters most. Jamie,
I'd just like to say, if anyone is listening to this, or is anyone in North London, come June, to come down to the Brimshaw School of Art degree show, because you'll see an absolutely fabulous show made by these fabulous young people.
Good. Well, it's nice to be able to help publicise such a thing, and well done. That's the plug which is allowed. It's the least we can do. Okay, well, thanks all very much, guys, for coming in, and thank you for listening, everybody, and we hope to see you and or listen, speak to you, sorry, you listen to us, we speak to you, that's the way it goes, next month on Art Monthly. Goodbye.